Well, I'm going to blow this early. Before I forget it, because I'm notorious for getting home 2 days after an event and thinking, oh gosh, I didn't thank the host committee. So let me thank the host committee for inviting me. And I want to tell you that this is a super host committee, because last night, the bellman came to the door with a little gift bag. Now, when I speak, people usually give me what they think I should eat. And I know God keeps sending me this message, but we're on the wrong wavelength right now, because they usually send me baskets of fruit. And since I stopped doing Carmen Miranda several years ago, I don't know what to do with it. Now, I know that some people eat it, so I do hand it out to folks, but last night, these people gave me a box of chocolates, a bag of Cool Ranch nacho chips, some licorice red twisties, bubble gum, and Tic Tacs. And I want you to know I'm set. There's enough sugar there to keep me flying for the rest of the weekend, probably into next weekend. Let me start by saying I am Rick Buchanan, and I'm a grateful, enthusiastic member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. Smooth. Yeah. We'll get into that later. And you know, I was listening to Mark last night, and I don't know how many of you were there last night and heard the AA speaker, but you know, he was so, you know, his story had all the drama and all the excitement, and it was alcoholism as I loved it. And I thought, yeah. And Mary Pearl said today that she was addicted to mood-altering men. I love drunks. I didn't know about their mood-altering, but usually they fell at my feet, and I thought that was love. And you know, they told me that the reason that they picked me for this time slot was that this is a really tough time after lunch, that people, you know, are getting a little sleepy. In fact, some folks have gone up to take a nap. And so my job was not only to tell my story, but to keep you awake. I'm not sure I can do that, but I did wear this tie. And if you can't see it from the back of the room, actually, if you can't see it from across the marina, you may want to go to your optometrist. You know, last night while I was listening to Mark, I was thinking about speaking today. And, you know, I realized that not only am I a grateful, enthusiastic member of Al-Anon, but I think it would be fair to describe me that on most days, I'm semi-sane. And I realized last night as I was listening to Mark that what that means is you'd have to hit me with a semi to get me to change my mind some days. And that's how it was before I came. You know, I grew up in alcoholism. My earliest memory is driving with my mother and brother across the state of Indiana to the Veterans Hospital in Danville, Illinois, where my father had been hospitalized. He'd had a nervous breakdown. That's what we called alcoholism in those days, and Daddy's nerves broke down a lot. And we really didn't understand what was happening. We saw the drinking And we thought that that was the problem. And we thought that when the drinking stopped, that that would be the end of our problem. And my parents went through all of the things that those of you who grew up in alcoholism do, you know, food across the floor, violence. Some of the violence was directed at me. I was the oldest one, so I was frequently the punching bag. And, you know, we never talked about it. We didn't act like anything was different. And so early on I learned not to trust. And I learned that you better keep anger to yourself. Because in my house, if you expressed anger, you got hit. And I learned to be afraid. And, you know, my dad would wake us up in the middle of the night. Now, he was not a happy drunk. And he would hallucinate. And so he would wake us up in the middle of the night, and he would see goblins outside the windows. And he would wake us all up and tell us that there were creatures crawling up the ladders into our windows and so forth. And I felt horribly alone because I didn't think that anyone else was living with this problem. And I kept thinking that if only he would stop drinking, our lives would be better. So my brother and I decided, my father was Scotch, and he drank beer. And so, well, too much money for Scotch. So, you know, anyway, he was a very prudent drinker. That meant before he passed out, he would put the cap on the bottle and put it into the refrigerator so that when he got up, he wouldn't have to waste the time to open a new bottle. And so my brother and I decided to put Menon's aftershave in one of the bottles. And he got up and he drank it. And he got violently ill. And actually he was sick for about a week and a half. And we felt really guilty. And during that week and a half, he didn't drink. So while we felt guilty, we thought that maybe we had done the right thing. But after he got over his food poisoning, he changed brands of beer. So I realized that it really didn't matter what we did. We were in a small neighborhood, and my father was so well known that the police would bring him home. It wasn't, you know, in the old days, that's how they avoided DUIs. The guys fell off the stool, and the bartender called the policeman, and the policeman would drive him home. And then we'd try to figure out where he put his car later. But this went on until I was 12 years old. And my parents were divorced. Now, my mother actually filed for divorce four separate times, and we did what I call the pre-Al-Anon waltz. She filed for divorce. He left. We didn't know where he was for 6 months. He would come back, tell us that he wouldn't drink anymore except on weekends. We kids would all beg, give him another chance. My mother would drop the divorce, and off we would go again. And she did that four times before she finally went through with it. And we thought that our problems were over because we didn't live with alcoholism anymore. Now, those of you who were either married to or grew up with alcoholics know you can't get rid of them. (Laughter) And as Mary Pearl said, you can't even drown them. And so, you know, he just kept popping back into our lives. And until he died when I was 21 from the disease of alcoholism. But other than the fact that we talked about the fact that Daddy drank a lot, we never talked about the impact that it was having on us. And we all pretended that it was having no impact. At the age of 9, I began to engage in sexual activity. It wasn't anything about love or lust. It really was, I was desperately looking for someone to tell me that they loved me. And, you know, that thing that they say about willing to go to any lengths, well, I thought this was one way to get attention and love. I was bright in school, but I was always in trouble. I know you'll find this hard to believe, but I got in trouble because I talked too much. And I was always getting in with the wrong kids. And again, it was that sense of any attention is better than no attention. At the age of 16, I decided that life wasn't worth living anymore, and I got up on a Saturday morning and I decided to commit suicide. And I went to the kitchen cabinet and I got out the aspirin bottle and I counted out 32 aspirin, and I swallowed them and laid down to die. Now, you know, we didn't have any drugs in our house, and I didn't, other than alcohol, I didn't know what would kill you or what wouldn't, but my sister had swallowed a bottle of baby aspirin when she was a baby, and they had to pump her stomach, so I knew aspirin was bad. Why I counted it, I don't know. But anyway, I laid down to die, and I saw my funeral, and I saw all of you going by the casket, and how sad you were that you hadn't been nicer to me. I was really loving this, but about an hour later, I was still alive. So I got up. I got up and I took 16 more aspirin and I laid back down to die. Now, this time, I did the flowers and the music. Well, as you can see, didn't work. Actually, all that happened was that I ended up with a horrible headache. And I was afraid to take any more aspirin. So, but you know, I really never told that story. I think I was 35 years old before anyone in my family ever knew that that had happened. And I went on through high school and into college believing that alcoholism had not affected me. And roommate after roommate and relationship after relationship, everybody seemed to drink a lot. And you know the pattern. They don't have the rent. I do. I'm working a second job. They're having problems at work. I can tell them how to fix it. And then sometimes there was the bizarre behavior. I woke up one night hearing running water, except it wasn't running water, and it wasn't in the bathroom. And And I wondered the next morning why I cleaned up the mess. But I just kept going on thinking that I was going to meet the perfect person, and that person was going to make me happy. And I already told you at the beginning that what happened usually was that they passed out at my feet, and I thought that that meant that they loved me. And if you said, "I need you," I was hooked for life. Or at least what seemed like life in an alcoholic relationship. I graduated from college, and I went to Ohio, and I hadn't been there very long, and I met this woman who was in Al-Anon, and her idea of the phrase attraction versus promotion was, you need Al-Anon, and you need Al-Anon now. And I assured her that alcoholism had not affected me, thank you very much, and I did not need to go to those meetings. Well, we played this little dance for about 2 years. She had a lot more patience than most of us. And finally she said to me, "You know, if you don't go to a meeting, I'm not going to listen to you anymore." I hated her. So in September of 1974, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting to convince her and to find out from all of you that alcoholism had not affected my life. And I was fairly certain that in a pretty short period of time, you would tell me, "You really don't need to be here." And it'll be 28 years in September. And, actually, it's more often that you tell me, "Keep coming back." So, you know. So I went to Al-Anon. Now, I don't remember what happened the first meeting. Actually, the first meeting that I intended to go to, I didn't. It was a big mess, but I went because I wanted to get this over with. It's like Mark was saying last night with the jail term, let's get it going. I was going to get this Al-Anon. I was going to get it early. I was not staying. And so I don't know what we did at the first meeting. I know you had those little blue books, those ODATs, you called them. The one day at a time. So, and that's about all we had when I started in the program. And so anyway, I bought one and I took it home. And the 12 steps were in the back. And I decided that if I was going to get out of this, that I'd better work the steps. So the first night after the first meeting, I began to work the steps. Now, when I went to Al-Anon, I already believed in God. Or I believed that I believed in God. And that I had a higher power. And I believed that I was powerless over alcoholism because I told you the alcoholic was already dead. I didn't count all the other people in my life. And I thought that was pretty powerless. So that was step one. And then, of course, you know, it says that we come to believe. And I told you I already did believe. Now, I didn't like the part about being insane and being restored to sanity because there was nothing wrong with me. Yeah. But I did believe that if I were insane, that God could restore me to sanity. So that was the second step. And then the third step, of course, is to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. And I told you I already believed in God, so third step. So that first night after the first meeting, I got a long legal pad and I made a fearless and searching moral inventory. I had 39 character defects, and I didn't feel a whole lot better. But I wasn't going to take any more aspirin. So I called this woman the next morning who'd gotten me into this, and I said, I went to the meeting last night, and I took the first four steps after I got home, and when she stopped laughing, she said, oh, what positive things do you have on your inventory? And I said, well, wait a minute. It says fearless, searching fearless moral inventory, right and wrong. It doesn't say anything about good and bad. So I made a shit list. And she said, well, no, that's not how it works. You have to put down a good thing before you can put down a second negative. And I couldn't think of anything good about me. In fact, it took me about 3 days, and I finally, in true adult child fashion, went to someone that I worked with and said, you know, I'm doing this moral inventory thing, and I'm supposed to have a characteristic, something that's good about me. Can you think of anything? Now, I mean, when I think about it, I'm surprised. You know, those are the kind of people nowadays that you, they work at the post office. And so, you know, and I was really close, probably. But, you know, she said, yes, Rick, it's your smile. When you smile, you make people feel happy. And I didn't think that counted, because I thought all of you smile. And she said, and your humor, it makes people feel warm. But you see, I used humor as a way to keep you away from me. And when Mary Pearl was talking about sarcasm, oh, that's probably for me. Tell them I'll get back to them. It's hard to be smooth. I didn't think it counted, but I put it down because she said I had to have something good. Now, I never got to 39 good things about me, or at least I didn't that first time. And I wonder sometimes why I kept coming back. But part of it was that I really didn't have any other place to go. There wasn't any other place where people understood part of what I was feeling. You see, I had left the relationship right before I went to Al-Anon because the other person made me lie. And that made perfect sense to me. And I had spent a lot of time taking care of you, but I had no idea how to take care of me. You know, I used to talk about the fact that I had such low self-esteem, but, you know, I was thinking last night as I was listening to the speaker, you know, it is true in Al-Anon that we do have low self-esteem, but I had a huge ego, and I had this huge need for you to notice me and for you to tell me that I was okay. And so, you know, I would go around and say, well, you can't expect me to do anything different. I grew up in an alcoholic family. And the woman who became my sponsor said, he's been dead for 6 years. How long are you going to carry that around? And I had to learn to do something different. You know, I'd been in the program about 2 years, and they said to me, we want you to do beginner's meetings. I think they wanted me to go to beginner's meetings, but they said, we want you to do beginner's meetings. And they said that I should do the third step. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever done beginner's meetings. I don't know how many of you have ever gone to beginner's meetings. But you know, the third step is a wonderful beginner's meeting, because everyone is absolutely elated to talk about God. Mm. I'm going to do the third step. And you already know about my experience with the steps, you know. So I don't know how many people we lost during that time. But anyway, everyone would come in, sit down, chat amiably, and then I would announce the topic and the body language would begin. I don't do God. If I have to do God, I'm not coming back here. Oh, you don't have to do God. Do you have a toilet? Yeah. Well, do you have a piece of paper? Yeah. Well, do you have a pencil? Yeah. Well, can you write your problem down on the piece of paper? Yeah. Can you wad it up and throw it in the toilet? Yeah. Then you understand the principle of letting go and letting God. Huh? Well, you're not going to put your hand in the toilet and take the problem back out, are you? And when you flush it, it's really gone. Now, the folks who believed in God were not really thrilled with that analogy. But I kept asking every time they had a group conscience meeting and they would hand out their jobs. I'd say, can I do another step? They said, no, you have to do the third step. You know, part of the reason that I had a problem with the steps initially was I didn't do the first step. I never got that it wasn't about the drinking. It was that I was powerless over the effects that alcoholism had had on me. The effects of the drinking. And I was probably in the program about 6 years before I finally got that. I kept going around. I was a lot of fun in meetings. I would make these grand statements. Some of you have done the same thing, I know. You know, you don't have to follow the steps. Or, you know, the steps really need to be changed. The wording, you know, give me a break. And do we have to have all this God? And does he have to be a he? And on and on and on. And people just said, see you next week, Rick. And, you know, I laugh nowadays because we get these letters in the office. And, you know, it's like they want to change this and they want to change that and they... You know, and I used to say to people, you don't have to work the steps in order, and it doesn't matter if you work them all or not. And I'm the executive director. But, you know, I came to understand that the steps are in order. And I don't have to work them. I can stay crazy. And that's my choice. But I don't get the bitch about it. If I choose to be crazy, my choice. But nobody's gonna pick me up. That's a choice I have to make. I hated the slogans. I heard people talk about easy does it. I didn't even want to talk about that one. But one day at a time. And I couldn't figure out how to live my life 1 minute at a time. Until that's what my sponsor said. Take a minute. Clear your mind for 1 minute. And string those minutes together. 1 minute every hour. And then 2 minutes. Until sometimes I would get to an hour, and even today, I can get most days. One day at a time. How important is it? You never lived with an alcoholic. What do you mean, how important is it? He's talking craziness. We have to convince them. How important is it? I was thinking right before I spoke, you know how every once in a while we get ourselves totally whacked. Maybe you don't, but I do. And I was thinking, as I was walking out before Mary Pearl started, I was going to the bathroom, and I was thinking how nice I looked and how much I loved wearing this tie and I loved the shirt. And I was just smiling from ear to ear, and I was walking out, and I walked into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and the tie was all twisted. And I thought I looked great. And when I flipped it over, it had breadcrumbs down the front. So it's like, get to thinking that you're too important, God gives you a little message. So how important is it? Well, I finally realized, I had to make up my own slogan for this. And Scott talked about last night, 6 billion people. Well, I didn't think big enough, because my slogan was 1 billion Chinese don't give a damn. Because I knew there were all those people over there who didn't know anything about me, and they didn't care whether I had breadcrumbs on my tie. You said, let go and let God. And even though we'd had the toilet story, I just didn't get it. There were some times that I wanted revenge. I wanted to make you pay. I understood when she was talking about if they hurt you. You know, and there used to be that thing about if they hurt you, hunt them down and kill them. That made sense to me. And then I'm in the meeting and you're saying, let go and let God. Let him what? And so one night in the meeting, someone said, well, I say, let go and let God get him. And I can do that. You know, nowadays I sponsor two folks, and that's a challenge just because of the amount of time that I travel, that I really can't be available as much as I'd like to be. But one of the new slogans that I developed, and I don't think it's in the literature yet, but it works for me, and it's especially during the whining time. Get over it. And you know, it really does work. It works for me, and it's worked for them. I mean, you can always tell when a slogan works, because when the other person says the slogan, you don't say, yes, but. And so I have to get over it a lot. You know, I went through service. I started in service as an intergroup representative. I didn't know what one was. You said the meeting's on Tuesday night. We'll go with you. You did. I went to two meetings with you. Third meeting, you said, we'll meet you there. You didn't show up. Didn't matter, because by that time I knew what I was supposed to do. Now, I don't know about your intergroup, but in our intergroup, we revise the guidelines annually. Sometimes more than once. I never figured out why, because we never followed them. But we spent hours on the commas and the periods in them. Life-altering stuff makes a difference whether or not we reach out to families and friends of alcoholics if the comma's in the wrong place. But you know, then you said, now it's time to be the GR. And I don't know what a group representative was, but I went to the assembly and I hated it because they fought at that assembly. Now, I know that doesn't happen here in Southern California, but in Ohio, they just can't get along. And so they always write to that World Service office. And we would have times that this one would get up and they're waving a letter from the World Service Office, and then someone from the other side would get up and they're waving a letter from the World Service Office. Now, that wasn't logical to me. because they both claimed that it supported their view. Well, you know what happens. You read the letters. If you write to me today, you'll get the same letter. We have it on computer. Talk to each other. Reason things out. We don't take positions because it's up to the autonomy of the group or the area in matters, except when affects Al-Anon or AA as a whole. But you know what I learned in those meetings was how to fight fair. Because in my family, if you did one of two things. You either hit when you fought, or you threw things, and then you never talked about it. Didn't happen. But at the assembly, they would be going back and forth about whether or not the GR's expenses should be paid by the group. Like, and after the vote, they all went out to dinner. And they talked about their families and they had a good time and they always hugged. And you know, my sponsor said you could try that at home. If you stick to what is yours, you can say how you feel. Can't say how he makes you feel. You can say how you feel. And let it go. Doesn't matter. Two people can be right. Where do they get this stuff? You know. But it works. And I learned no is a complete answer. Just breathe a lot. No. No. And the other thing that I've learned recently, which works even better with the staff, is instead of saying no, I go, oh. Gives me time to think. Gives me time to think. I became a trustee because somebody told me they needed me, and I didn't really know what a trustee was either, but I studied the handbook and I did all this stuff, and I went to New York. They told me that I had been selected as a candidate, and I went to New York to meet with the board, and you know, I thought that at the group that we could practice these principles in all our affairs. Talk about smoking in the group. And then I thought at the assembly, well, those folks will have it. They'll practice these principles. Well, I already told you about that. So I knew that when I went to the trustees, that these would be, I guess, smooth people. Yeah. Well, I've had to work my program more the higher that I've gone in service, because it's important for me to remember, easy does it. And I don't have to be right. And those weren't ideas that I grew up with in alcoholism. You know, I told you about fear, and one night in the meeting we were talking about fear, and somebody said, well, I just can't get an idea of how to get over fear. So I shared with them something that I had learned in the program. I don't know about you, but I'm deathly afraid of roller coasters. And you know, it's almost like alcoholism for me. You know, you get on at the beginning, you think it's going to be wonderful. You know, now you're going up the hill. You know, that roar of the first excitement. Oh, the relationship's going to be so great. You get to the top of the hill and you look down and you go, oh, God. And about that time, you grab on the roller coaster bar and hold on. And in 2 minutes, it's over. And that's how I do fear. I see myself with God on the roller coaster. And when I get to the top of the hill, when I think I can't go on, I grab the bar and say, okay, God, let's go. And it works. And you know, the thing is with me and roller coasters, it's like I said, it's just like alcoholism. Even though I know what's going to happen, I keep getting back in the car to go on another time. In 1994, I had a heart attack right after the conference, and I had quadruple bypass surgery in October. Was not my plan. And I thought that my life was over because I thought no one will want me because I have scars. And I was 48 years old. You shouldn't, you know, 48-year-old people aren't supposed to have bypass surgery. Well, we all know about that. But anyway, after the surgery, I decided that I needed to change jobs, that I needed to find a less stressful job. I was practicing law, and I decided that I needed to find a less stressful job. So I told the executive director of Al-Anon that I was looking for a job, and then I thought that I might like to work in nonprofits, and would she be a reference? And she said, yes, but don't forget about Al-Anon. And I said, well, they're really, you know, you're the executive director of Al-Anon, and there aren't any jobs. And she said, well, I know, but just don't forget about Al-Anon. And the following summer, she announced that she was going to retire and that she wasn't going to move when we relocated to Virginia Beach. And I was picked in October of 1995, and I moved to New York in January of 96, and I was there for 5 months before we moved to Virginia Beach. Being the executive director has been, it's really been one of the most wonderful jobs that I could ever imagine. People laugh when I say that I took the job because it was less stressful. Because every time you have 56 employees, there is a little bit of stress from time to time. And when you're dealing with Al-Anon members, you know, we all have an opinion. You told us we could have one, and we've got it. And so, you know, sometimes that gets to be a little stressful, but, you know, I had a spiritual awakening last year. I realized that an angry Al-Anon member is somebody that just needs a little more information. And if I don't react to their anger and ask them, what else could I tell you that would help you to change your position, that it's very helpful. Sometimes they're very honest and they say, nothing. You can tell me nothing that will change my mind. And I thank them. And I tell them nothing. If you can't change your mind, God bless you. I don't have to change your mind. I learned that here. Someone said to me before I spoke, I have a very high, don't disappoint me. I said, I'm not taking that. That was the old me. You had to like me, and I had to meet all of your expectations. But you've told me I don't have to do that anymore. I just have to be me. I want to close by telling you a story. Now, having been in this job, I've had the joy of being in an Al-Anon meeting in Russia, and having gone to the second national meeting in Russia, where 108 groups attended. And you know, we complain. I heard someone, I think Kay was talking about, people object if they have to drive 2 hours to the assembly. There was a woman at this meeting who rode the train from Siberia for 2 days to come to that weekend. And she paid her own expenses. You know, there isn't enough Al-Anon love to replace that kind of dedication. And last month, I was in Costa Rica, Venezuela, and Argentina, and I met with, in Costa Rica, we met with Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, Nicaragua, as well as Costa Rica. In Venezuela, we met with Colombia and Venezuela, and in Buenos Aires, we met with Brazil, Chile, and Uruguay, as well as Argentina. And we had some really open, honest discussions, and they took me to an Al-Anon meeting in Spanish in Venezuela, and I got up and spoke in Spanish. Sorry you all missed it. But I was able to make myself, basically I told them when I came to Al-Anon I was crazy, and they all agreed. And but, you know, I didn't understand every word of what was being said in the meeting, but I did understand that level of fear that you have when we first come, and that dedication to the program when we stay. My first job as executive director was really to help the current executive director get ready for a presentation that she was supposed to make to the conference on the new structure. And she wasn't really someone who liked to talk a lot at the microphone, and so we had these overhead projector, we had this overhead projector presentation, and we practiced, and we were really quite good at it. And the way that we worked it was she spoke at the mic and I flipped the slides, so she didn't have to try to do two things at the same time. And so we practiced and we were all ready, and we were going to give it to the board first. And this was in January. I had started work January the 1st. This was like January the 20th. And so we had practiced in her room, and it came time for the presentation with the board. And I went outside, and I was looking for the bellman, but I couldn't find him. So I thought, well, you know, how heavy is an overhead projector? And so I went upstairs, and I had her key, and I went up, and I got the overhead projector. Now, the board is waiting, so I'm in a hurry. So I gather up the overhead projector. I didn't pack it up. That would have made sense. Picked it up, and I got the cord in this hand, and I have the overhead projector, and I hit the button for the elevator, and I get on the elevator, and just as the elevator door closes, I look down and realize that the plug for the overhead projector is outside the door. Now, I tried to hit the buttons, but the elevator began to go down. Now, I didn't quite know what to do, so I went over in the corner of the elevator and I held on to the overhead projector as hard as I could, because I thought that at least what would happen is that the cord would snap. But I knew that there was a problem when the cord began to go up the side of the elevator door. And I was standing in the corner, hanging on for dear life, and wondering what I should do next. When the cord got to the top of the door, the overhead projector was pulled out of my hands, flew across the elevator, and began to now slowly crawl up the elevator door. And I didn't know what to do, and so I was standing in the corner sort of, and I didn't know whether to run over, but then I thought, well, if it falls and it falls on me and I get cut, that's not good, but God had a better idea, because at that point the cord did snap and the overhead projector went crashing to the floor, and at the same time, the door to the elevator opened. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been in New York City, but when doors open, people come in. And so here is the overhead projector now laying in the middle of the floor, and I'm trying to tell the mass of people who want to get on the elevator, no, no, wait. And I had to go and get the bellman, and I left out that the overhead projector belonged to the hotel. And I had to now go tell the board. Now, this is my first job as executive director in training. And I had to go tell the board what had happened. I was devastated. And I told the story. And they responded, like most of you. And there were some folks who were out of the room. Tell it again. Tell it again. Come over here. And I'm getting more and more upset. And they're laughing harder and harder. And about this time, two men come in from the back of the room. And the director of business services, uh-oh, you're in trouble now. It's the overhead police. Now, I tell that story to close because it really was in service that my program began to take off, and it was in service that I learned to live with an alcoholic family, and it was in service that I learned that I could have relationships with healthy people. And so, if you've been thinking about whether you're good enough or whether you have enough time or whether there is a job that's just right for you, or if you've been waiting for someone to recognize your talent and ask you, let me invite you, as the executive director, to consider sticking your hand up the next time someone asks for someone in your group or to be an Alateen sponsor. You know, Alateens can't have a meeting without one of us. Or carrying the message to a prison, or signing up at the inner group. Whatever the service job. And again, if you get that old tape that says, well, I don't know, maybe I'm not good enough, remember, they made me the executive director. Thank you.